funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
When teenagers do something dangerous or dumb, the adults who love them will often ask, why can't you use your brain? The thing is, they are. It's just that teenage brains don't work like adult ones do. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Adolescent brains are sharp and sensitive and very good at remembering things, but they're also uniquely drawn to novelty, attuned to relationships, and tolerant of risks that most full-grown people think are a bad idea. Could it be that they're better at judging risk than their parents? Behavioral neuroscientist Adriana Galvan is associate professor in the Department of Psychology at the Brain Research Institute at UCLA. She's fascinated by the ways that teenage brains function differently from brains at any other stage of human development. You can find a link to more information about her work at think.kera.org. Adriana, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
What makes the strengths and weaknesses of adolescent brains so noteworthy in comparison to either children or full-grown adults?
There are several changes that happen in the brain that makes them really special. One, and the one that's received the most research, is that the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain right above your eyes, continues to develop through the mid-20s. However, we've recently discovered, along with other labs, that there's a lot of change underneath the hood and deeper regions of the brain that help them explore, process risk, make them a little bit more interested in taking risks and seeking things out that are rewarding. And so together, these changes in the brain make them act the way they act as teenagers, sometimes impulsive, always exploratory, and I think always interesting.
They are always interesting. Conventional wisdom defines adolescence as the years basically middle and high school. Does brain science have a different definition?
Scientists have really struggled to define when adolescence starts and when it ends. And it's something that we actually grapple with, even within the field. Generally, we agree that adolescence is jump-started by puberty. So when pubertal hormones kick in, they really start influencing a lot of changes in the brain and physical growth, of course. But the end of adolescence is much harder to pinpoint. And in part, that's because of how we define adolescence or who we think of as adolescence in our society. And so generally, adolescence is thought to end around the time of going to college or accepting other adult-like responsibilities. But that's also changing as kids go to college and remain more dependent on their parents financially for a longer period of time. Another wrinkle is that we've – not wrinkle, but it's actually more knowledge. We know that the brain continues to develop through the mid-20s. And so we've started to think that adolescence certainly doesn't end right at 18 when someone turns 18, but rather when their brain starts to become so refined as to be less plastic.
What does the mesolimbic dopamine system do?
The mesolimbic dopamine system is a part of the brain that is implicated in a lot of different things, namely responding to novelty, to learning about the environment, to explore. And it is triggered by the release of a neurotransmitter called dopamine. And dopamine is released when the organism finds something pleasurable or novel or is simply learning something new. And what's interesting about adolescence is that there's more dopamine in the adolescent brain than earlier in life or later in life. So in response to the very same stimulus, a rewarding piece of chocolate or something, the adolescent brain will release more dopamine, therefore making that experience seem more pleasurable.
So more pleasurable, I guess more vivid. Does that have anything to do with why our memories of things that happen in adolescence seem to be so sharp even decades later?
Isn't that amazing? There's something called the reminiscence bump. And the idea is that we remember things from our adolescent period more vividly, as you say, perhaps a little bit more fondly than we would if we had experienced the same thing later in life. And scientists think this is exactly because of the changes in the mesolimbic dopamine system, that the mesolimbic system not only fires more dopamine during this time, but that firing of dopamine serves as a glue to gel the memories more firmly into place during adolescence.
Do they actually learn from their mistakes?
Yes, we all learn from our mistakes, and adolescents do as well. They use the same circuitry that adults do in the brain to learn from trial and error. It's the same mechanisms that are in place even from very early age and early development. So You know, one thing I always think of is that toddlers learn a lot about the world through trial and error. So the average infant learning to walk, for instance, falls 100 times a day. And that means that that is a learning process. They're failing and getting up again. And adolescence is another representation of that, of falling and getting back up. Some mistakes have to be kind of had over and over before they learn, but certainly the brain is paying attention to those things.
Do they do better with like organic consequences than with artificial punishments or discipline?
Well, I think they do better with immediate consequences. Mm-hmm. So the adolescent brain is very good at holding on to the here and now. And so when punishments or consequences are delayed in the future, they're much harder to imagine. They're much harder to take them as real. And so that's one reason scientists think that interventions or preventions that aim to reduce smoking, for instance, in adolescents are not effective if the focus is on the long-term consequences of health, for instance, rather than on the immediate negative aspects.
So the immediate negative aspects are things like you'll have terrible breath and people
exactly.
will think you're gross.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You won't look good. Your skin will suffer. Those messages are much more effective at reducing smoking in teenagers than the longer term health consequences. And also, one study found that what was most effective was raising the cost of cigarettes, because that's an immediate consequence that teenagers feel right away.
People are always worried about the effect of peer pressure, but it goes both ways, right? They can be influenced to do good things by their friends and bad things. Why are they more susceptible to peer influence than older folks?
Yeah, adolescents really are going through a period of life where they find peers particularly interesting. It's not to say that younger kids don't care about their friends or their peers, and it's not to say that teenagers don't care about what their parents think. In fact, we have data to suggest that the influence of parents and peers is pretty equivalent during adolescence. But the reason peers are particularly salient is because there are changes in something called the social brain. So regions in the brain that are interested in facial expressions or emotional valence are really active and excitable during adolescence. And so in the presence of peers, these systems are kind of influencing adolescent behavior more so than in younger or older kids.
So over thousands and thousands of years, as modern humans were evolving, one would assume that adolescents spent time in communities where people of all ages spent a lot of time together. And the way we do education now in particular means they spend hours and hours on end with people their own age. What are the pros and cons of that?
That's a really good question. And I agree. The way adolescents are reared has changed across generations. The consequences of spending time only with people in your peer group is that you may not get either access to more direct guidance from adults, from others who are more experienced. And on the flip side, spending less time with younger kids gives less of an opportunity for responsibility for someone else, of caring for another, for helping someone navigate the day the way that adolescents may benefit from that as well from older individuals.
So Margaret Mead famously discovered that adolescence was a very different phenomenon in Samoa in the 1920s than it was in the United States. But the brain development, I gather, is identical no matter where you are in the world, no matter what culture you're growing up in.
A recent study by Larry Steinberg studied this very question. And what he and his colleagues did is that they examined behavior in adolescents from, I believe it was over about 40 or 50 countries from different types of rearing environments and cultures. And they found exactly that the behaviors that we see in the U.S. in adolescents, including increased sensation seeking, for instance, was observed in all these other countries around the world as well.
People blame hormones for all kinds of bad teenage behavior, and certainly that is something that's changing. But you found that sleep deprivation is overlooked a lot.
Sleep is a basic need that suffers during adolescence. We've done incredible work trying to determine the effects of nutrition or education or cognition. But sleep in adolescence has really fallen behind because there's kind of this narrative in particular in our culture that as we get older, we need less and less sleep. But that's certainly not true of adolescents. They need just as much sleep as they did right before they were adolescents. And yet they get less of it because they go to bed later and later. And it's not simply because of social media or because they're chatting with their friends or doing homework, but the adolescent brain actually has changes in its circadian rhythm around the time of puberty. And so the hormone that induces sleepiness, melatonin, actually is released later in the night in teenagers. And so they simply don't feel sleepy at 9 or 10 o'clock. And so this leads to going to bed later. But in the morning, they still have to get up at the same time. And in fact, school start time is getting earlier and earlier. And so this is shrinking the amount of time that adolescents are sleeping. And our data are suggesting that it's having consequences on brain development.
So if you could design the right hours for school for teenagers, what would it be?
That is a I don't know what it would be. I'm not sure I would reorganize exactly the school start times, but perhaps reorganize the day. So maybe right when they get to school, they shouldn't be doing the more complex cognitive tasks that their brains aren't ready for. Their brains are more awake in the middle of the day. So maybe we should save math and English and those types of subjects for the middle of the day.
How do they figure out their identities as they move through adolescence?
Identity exploration is one key function of adolescence. We all wear many different hats as we try to determine what suits us, where energizes us. And I think that this is one of those places where peers play a really critical role of helping adolescents shape and identify who they want to be and what they want to pursue.
So should adults try to influence who their kids are hanging out with? Is that even possible?
It's probably possible in the logistical sense, but kids are going to gravitate towards the peers who interest them. And instead, I think keeping communication open to know who those peers are is a better approach for parenting, because kids and teenagers, like everyone else, don't like being told what to do. And so parents who instead seem to work with the teenager will probably be more effective in getting them to share their lives.
You know that adolescents are uniquely open to really getting behind causes that mean a lot to them. What is going on in their brains that makes that true of them?
One really important and beautiful thing about the adolescent brain is that they are wholeheartedly passionate about things that they believe in. And in part, this is because of the changes in the mesolimbic dopamine system. That this system, because it's more sensitive to the environment, is encouraging them to pursue things that they're interested in. And so when they're into something, they're not a little bit interested. They really want to make a difference. And also, often these causes are very social in nature. And so that helps them establish their identities and form strong bonds that they are looking for.
Should we worry about teenagers who do everything they're told?
Yes. I think adolescents should explore and be encouraged to do so. And exploration doesn't have to be negative. Exploration doesn't have to necessarily mean health compromising risks, but exploring new, like we were saying, new causes or new activities, or simply taking risks that adults may not perceive as risks, like raising your hand in class or seeking out new friendships. That's highly risky to an adolescent. And their brains will help them do that in a way that they will never do again later in life. And so doing exactly what you're told is probably not giving the adolescent the opportunity to explore new ways of learning.
We're speaking this hour with Adriana Galvan, who is a neuroscientist and associate professor in the Department of Psychology and the Brain Research Institute at UCLA. We're talking about how adolescent brains work. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the summer of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with neuroscientist Adriana Galvan, who's associate professor in the Department of Psychology and the Brain Research Institute at UCLA. We're talking about how adolescent brains work. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. Okay, Adriana, adolescents do a lot of things that adults think are a really bad idea. Do they process risk and reward differently than we do?
Yes. Well, first, they process risk differently because the consequences of that risk are not at the forefront of their brain. They are thinking about the immediate rewards of the risk. And so they basically turn reward and risk on its head and overvalue the potential rewards. The other thing is that what we think is risky may not be risky to them because it may serve a purpose of gaining social status, for instance. And that is actually a very developmentally appropriate task that they're trying to achieve. When they get into trouble is probably when they realize that the risks were not such a great idea.
Is there a chance that they're right, that we worry too much about things that, relatively speaking, are not all that dangerous?
The brain is looking for exploration and novelty. And adolescents get that through taking risks. And so if we hover too much and preclude all risks, then I think that we're robbing them of the opportunity of changing the brain in really important ways. Of course, that's not to say that they should engage in risks that are health compromising or can really get them in trouble. But it is important to let them explore a healthy dose of risk.
To be clear, though, it's not like teenagers have a death wish, by and large, right? I mean, they think that they're stopping themselves before they do anything deadly.
Yes. Teenagers do not do risks to get hurt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They just sometimes
they
do.
They sometimes do, yeah.
As they think about outcomes, you say they overvalue the rewards. What kinds of behaviors does that cause them to want to do? Like, are they showing off for their peers? Like, what does that lead to specifically?
Yeah, so if one type of reward is a social reward. And if you're getting a lot of positive feedback from peers for being really funny or for kind of being the daredevil, that's a really valuable reward that adults feel as well. But adults may also be thinking about the consequences in conjunction with that reward, whereas teens are mostly focused on that reward and less so on the consequences.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone now to Aaron in Bedford. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, this is Aaron in Bedford.
Hi.
Wonderful show. Amazing content. My question to you is a little bit layered. I coach preschool gymnastics, and I also coach preschool swimming. And of all things, I'm a horseshoer, so I deal with a lot of animals and a lot of kids. And for 35 years. Love the adolescent age. I read an article years ago in the December 94 issue of National Geographic about animals at play and how important play is. And the three types of play are by yourself, with a toy, or with others for play fighting and interaction and cooperation. My question to you is that I believe that 80% of personality is genetic and 20% is environmental. Within a group of peers, aren't these adolescents always developing, maintaining, and with that, a little while ago you mentioned risk, and within that group of risk, they're always addressing risk, reassessing risk, and then in the end, attempting risk. And I'll take my answer off here.
Thanks for your call. So I guess really, how are they assessing their risks as they go along and maybe adjusting the kinds of risk they take?
Well, I think that it's true that they're certainly adjusting the risk, not only based on the environment around them, but then as they age also, you know, as the prefrontal cortex comes online, they're better able to adapt to the environment in more real-time ways. So they may be learning more quickly, for instance, or they may have had a bad experience that redirects the type of risk that they take. But certainly peers play a huge role in that as well.
I don't know if this tracks with your research, but there has been a great deal of reporting in general media lately about the rise in anxiety among adolescents. It seems to be a phenomenon that we haven't seen before. What could be behind that?
Anxiety and other psychopathology really peaks during adolescence, or the onset of it really peaks in adolescence. And this has been an area of intense inquiry because scientists want to know, is this the product of increases in pubertal hormones? And those probably play a role. But it probably does also have to do with the increasing pressures that adolescents face in terms of planning for the future, of getting into the right school, of getting into the right peer group. And so all of these pressures are boiling up into anxiety in some individuals. But I think one way that we can help adolescents, you know, to have some perspective and maybe decrease their anxieties, to really remind them that there's no one path to success. And we may be giving them inadvertently a message that in order to be successful, they have to do A, B, C, and D. And that's certainly not the case. Many of us are, you know, adults and, you know, functioning adults who arrived here from very different paths.
Nobody likes to be embarrassed, but it does seem that teenagers are like exquisitely attuned to wearing something, doing something, saying something that their friends will think is uncool. What's going on there?
In adolescence, there's this really interesting tension between fitting in and standing out. And I think that's sometimes what leads them to kind of take risks, like in their fashion choices or in their friend choices. But when the collective, their friend group, doesn't approve, that can be horribly embarrassing. And that is because of this tension. You never want to be the person who sticks out or is excluded, but you also want to be the person within a group who stands out.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll speak now with Donna in Frisco. Hi, Donna.
Hi, Chris. Professor Galvan, I hope I said your name correctly. This is a wonderful discussion. Two quick observations and a question. I was a professional ballet dancer, and I went to a professional ballet boarding school at 14, as did many of my fellow students. And I can tell you, I never experienced this sort of phenomenon, this American adolescent phenomenon. We were all very disciplined. We weren't worried about what our peers thought of us. We were worried about how well we were dancing, period. So that's one thing. So what I'm trying to say is I don't totally buy the idea. It's sort of like what Chris brought up earlier about Margaret Mead and the Samoan teenage period. I think this is, to a degree, a social construct. The second thing I wanted to say is a psychiatrist observed that schizophrenia manifests itself much, much later in the European population than in America. He observed that everything seemed to be speeded up here.
Well, what do you think about those ideas, Adriana?
Well, the first idea is an interesting one, and I think it speaks to how malleable and adaptable the brain is. And so being in an environment where everyone else in your peer group are, you know, exerting a lot of or exhibiting a lot of discipline and atypical, you know, adolescent behaviors of risk-taking means that the brain is responding to that and, in turn, also adjusting and being more disciplined. The second one, that schizophrenia or other maladies are sped up in this society, is an interesting one that I don't know the data on that.
One of the risks that really worries adults is that adolescents will experiment with drugs and alcohol. And experimenting is one thing, and then developing a problem is another. Is a zero tolerance policy the way to go officially when kids try forbidden things?
It's a challenging policy question, because if we try to institute a zero tolerance policy, then if what happens when adolescents engage in these behaviors and then we don't have an answer or a way to ameliorate the potentially negative effects? However, it is a concern of experimenting with drugs and alcohol because we don't know who will become addicted. We don't know who is genetically susceptible to it, for instance. But the truth is that the majority of adolescents go through this period and at some point do experiment with alcohol, or marijuana is the most commonly used drug among adolescents. And so I think our efforts should instead be to educate them about the potential consequences of it.
So if you tell them that something horrible will happen and it doesn't happen, they're not going to believe what you have to say.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And so they are very good at learning about trial or, you know, action and consequence. And so if adults have this constant narrative of just pathology and negative, and then those things don't happen, then there's very little reason for them to believe, you know, subsequent messages about that are aimed at scaring them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email us at think@kera.org. Let's speak now with Tom in Arlington. Hi, Tom.
Hello. Man, this is perfect because what you just said is related to my question. Just a little backstory. When I was 17, I got into serious legal trouble, like felony-type legal trouble. And, you know, now that I'm older, I'm in my mid-20s now, and I succeeded through it. I went to college. I did good. I turned my life around. But I look back, like, 17, I was so stupid. When I was 19, I look back, I was dumb. When I was 21, I said I was dumb when I was 19. And basically what I want to get at with this is, like, I made this serious choice that had a strong negative effect on my life, and I can get jobs now because it's been so long ago, but at what point, because I know some states don't charge people as adults until they're 18, or, but in Texas, they charge me as an adult, as a 17-year-old. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, what point does adolescent mind shift to an adult-type thinking? Like, when should we really be charging these adolescents as adults for their crimes, and when should we, you know, treat them as adolescents?
That is a very important question, and juvenile justice policy in this country is thinking a lot about these questions and how best to address them, knowing what we know about developmental psychology and neuroscience of the adolescent brain. And the question about when adolescents turn into adults, or when we should start trying them as an adult, is one that's challenging because, as I said earlier, we don't have an end point per se of when adolescence ends. However, the U.S. Supreme Court has taken the position that so long as the brain remains plastic, as we know the adolescent brain is, then it is unconstitutional to treat it as though it is incapable of change. And so the position is that it is important to help adolescents try to redirect their trajectory if they've made some choices in the past that they now wish to redirect.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Adriana Galvan, a neuroscientist at UCLA. We're talking about how teenage brains work. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email think@kera.org. You can find us on Twitter at @KERAThink, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Should we let them drive, Adriana?
I think that driving is one of those skills that you need experience and maturation to be able to do. And so in California, we have a graduated driving program where you know, maybe it's all states, but you can't drive with friends in the car, for instance, at first, and you have to drive with parents and whatever. And this really tracks with what we know is going on in the brain, that initially you were very susceptible to social influence. And so that's why it makes sense not to have friends in the car, that your prefrontal cortex is helping you reason better and have faster reaction time. And so that makes you a better driver. But it's interesting because, you know, some states have tried to raise the driving age. And one study that comes to mind found that if they raise the driving age from age 16 to 18, it reduced the number of car accidents in 16-year-olds, but it significantly increased them in 18-year-olds. And so that speaks to the utility of experience. I think that we certainly need to be careful about driving.
All right. Back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Sarah calling from Dallas. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Yes, I had a quick question. I just wanted to know if a teenager uses drugs or alcohol regularly, will that stop their brain from maturing?
The data on the effects of drug are actually quite mixed, and that's because historically they've been conducted in rather small sample sizes. But the National Institutes of Drug Abuse recently launched a large 10-year study where multiple sites are going to track adolescents, at kids starting at age 10 through about age 20, and track those who initiate drug use and those who do not, to determine the effects over a long term in a very large number of kids, about 10,000 kids from across the country. And so that will be the first very large study to tell us about the effects with some greater certainty than we know now.
Is there an evolutionary purpose for the fact that their emotions are running at full throttle before the regulatory parts of their brain that help them make good decisions are fully developed? Seems like a bad mismatch.
One function of adolescence is to establish autonomy from caregivers, to start making their own decisions, to have confidence in their own decisions. And there's the idea, and the data support this, that having a very emotional brain, or that is very sensitive to emotion, helps them learn more quickly, because we learn from emotions, one thing, but also maybe to seek out new friendships that helps them leave the natal group. And this is observed not just in humans, but in monkeys or in rodents. In what is their equivalent juvenile period, they also show this greater reward sensitivity or emotion processing. And so it seems to be evolutionarily conserved to have this period of life where there's just greater emotion and exploration.
So you don't want them living in their childhood bedroom until they're 35?
No, you don't.
All right, let's go back to the phone now. We have Sam calling from Arlington. Hi, Sam.
Hey, how are you? Good afternoon.
Hi.
Yes, I have a couple of questions, but I grew up in Nigeria, that's in Africa, so, like, we were disciplined a lot. And for me, I believe that if not for the discipline I got back then, okay, mm-hmm. I wouldn't be where I'm at today. Mm-hmm. So my question is this. Mm-hmm. Does discipline help shape the mind and thinking of teenagers as they grow up? And the second thing is this. Bad behavior and violence, for especially American teenagers, is way more common than back home. So what is the cause of that? Those are the two questions I have.
All right, Sam, thank you so much. We're going to take a quick break now, and we'll get answers for you right after that. We are speaking this hour with neuroscientist Adriana Galvan, who's associate professor in the Department of Psychology and Brain Research Institute at UCLA. We're talking about how teenage brains work. If you've got questions, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like Diane Jay, internationally published creative writer. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with neuroscientist Adriana Galvan, who's associate professor in the Department of Psychology and the Brain Research Institute at UCLA. We're talking about how teenage brains work. Before the brain, Adriana, we heard from Sam, who wanted to know about the importance of discipline for teenagers.
Like all other experiences, discipline is an important agent of shaping the adolescent brain. And so it depends, of course, on the discipline, but providing boundaries and structure is very helpful for the brain of any age. And so in ways that are healthy and effective for the adolescent, yes, they can serve a good purpose. But discipline that is restrictive and squashes creativity and exploration is actually counterproductive to the adolescent brain health.
So can you give us some specifics?
Yeah.
Are you saying grounding is a bad idea?
No, I don't think grounding. I think grounding and, removing privileges as based directly on a particular action is actually quite effective, because mm-hmm. there's a cause and there's an effect that the adolescent can immediately experience. Depriving an adolescent of a privilege that has nothing to do with whatever they did wrong is probably less effective, because then it shows the adolescent that the world is unpredictable and that parents are not as trustworthy. And in particular, if they don't follow through on the discipline, or change it midstream, or make it harsher, or aren't consistent.
Are U.S. teens, as far as you know, any more prone to violence than teenagers in other parts of the world?
I don't know the answer to that.
All right. Let's move on. We will go back to the phones, and this time we'll speak with Millie in Atlanta. Hi, Millie.
Hi. I'm needing to ask about teenage pregnancy and parenting in that their brain continues to develop, and I'll just listen to the answer off the phone.
Thanks for your call. It's an interesting question because we know that centuries ago, it wasn't so unusual for teenagers to bring a child into the world. Today, we consider it very inadvisable.
Yeah. Pregnancy and teen sex is actually something that the adolescent neuroscience community has not done much research on, which is really interesting. And I find it interesting because the entire, you know, biological reason that we have adolescence is because of the influx of hormones that happens, you know, at around 10, 11, 12. But how being a teenage mom changes the brain is something we do not know. However, we do know that it brings about different responsibilities that, of course, their peers are not experiencing. And so they are already not in the same, peer group that they were probably before they had a baby. But also pregnancy in anyone releases different hormones that are also going to shape the brain in different ways.
Why do you think this hasn't been widely studied? Is it just a third rail topic?
I think it's challenging to study. I think that there's been less in, you know, the field of adolescent neuroscience is relatively new. And that only came about because we can now peer into the teenage brain with brain scans. And so I think that sex and sexuality has just been less on the radar. But increasingly, people recognize that it's the elephant in the room. We need to talk about how romantic feelings shape adolescent experience and in turn also shape adolescent brain development.
So you can put teenagers in a lab, you can put them into a scanner, you can hook them up to electrodes, you can watch them through a two-way mirror. What does it take to observe adolescent behavior in the wild?
Yeah, that's what we want to know. So some labs, what they do to kind of trying to simulate a little bit is to ask teenagers to bring their friends to the laboratory as well. And that has been effective and has shown some interesting findings that, for instance, if you have a peer in the room, your reward system is more active than if the peer is not in the room. And so that's very interesting. But I think some of us are moving towards using more, you know, mobile devices, like really taking advantage of the fact that kids are always on social media. And so trying to track their behavior and their feelings across the day and then maybe get them into the scanner later that day based on how they behave during the day or the feelings they felt may be one way to approximate it. But it is a tricky logistical issue that we need to get around.
So from one day to the next, depending on what I have most recently read, I go back and forth between being really alarmed about the proliferation of mobile technology, mm-hmm. particularly in the hands of teenagers. And then I think, well, we panicked about, you know, there were times when people thought that writing would be really bad for human communication. How can we approach the rules and decisions we make about teenagers and technology with science behind us?
We are in no position to say whether social media or technology is good or bad for brain development, in part because technology moves so quickly that we can't keep up with Instagram and Snapchat and all of the sources of media that they engage in to see the particular effects of each one of them. But like you say, the introduction of any sort of new mode of communication can be alarming. And so, I personally think that social media is just another example of that type of innovative new way of communicating. And what we do know is that what social media is doing is amplifying the behaviors and feelings and motivations that adolescents are already engaged in, right? It's amplifying the influence of peers. It's amplifying their sleep delay. It's amplifying their access to the world in a way that may be really beneficial for them. And so the jury's still out, but the brain is not reinventing a special social media brain area, for instance. It's going to rely on the same circuitry that it did for any other source of media before it, of communication before it.
All right, let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Let's go now to Jeffrey in Denton. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi. So I've heard you talk about the term plasticity in regards to adolescence, and I actually work at a neuro rehabilitation clinic where we we use neuroplasticity and, techniques to help people recover from traumatic brain injuries and strokes. I guess I was wondering if you could kind of say more about the difference between adolescents and adults on the plasticity.
Really good question. So plasticity in adolescence is what's called developmental plasticity. That is that the brain is more receptive to the inputs from the environment, similar to how when we're first born, the brain is highly plastic in terms of speech, in terms of bonding with the mother, in terms of any other sources of sensory input. Adult plasticity is distinct because in adults, the brain still changes, right? Every time we learn something, the brain is creating new synapses, for instance. However, those synapses must be integrated into an existing mature system, whereas in adolescence, the system is still in flux. And so there's more room for the introduction of new information without disturbing or disrupting what's already there. And so this is both the flexibility is good for adolescents because they can learn things much more quickly, such as social media. But it also makes anything that's already existing a little bit more permeable to new input.
Are there ways to help adults remember what it felt like to be a teenager? Would that be useful to kids?
I think it would be really useful. It's quite remarkable how adults forget how beautiful it was to be so excitable and driven and giggly, because we forget all that, right? Even though I think we sometimes send adolescents a mixed message. On the one hand, get it together, figure out what you're going to do with your life. On the other hand, I wish I was young again. This is the best time of your life. And so I think in some way we do give them that message, but it's important for adults to remember how special it was.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go now to Johnny calling from Austin. Hi, Johnny.
Hi. I had a question about how traveling affected the adolescent brain. Like, say someone, instead of going to college after finishing high school, they traveled.
Traveling is, for anybody, a really good way to explore the world and learn new things, of course. And so, I don't know that there are hard data on contrasting traveling versus going to college, but any environment or situation that gives new input to the brain is certainly healthy and helps shape it.
As you learn more about how people in adolescence learn and how their brains are really good at remembering things and they learn from experiences and emotion, mm-hmm. are there clues there for how we could amend the education system?
Neuroscience and education is something that, these fields have really tried to collaborate to try to generate new ways of teaching. And in particular, I think one idea that's been effective and promising is really harnessing the adolescent brain's need for immediacy and for responding to the here and now. And so creating curricula that focus in on giving immediate feedback or helping adolescents feel important and responsible may be an effective way to teach.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is neuroscientist Adriana Galvan from the Brain Research Institute at UCLA. We're talking about how teenage brains work. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So many teenagers are eager to demonstrate that they do not need adult guidance, that they've got it under control. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they are mistaken about that. What do they still need from coaches and teachers and parents, despite the fact that they say they need nothing?
They need love and scaffolding. In this way, teenagers are not so different from 2-year-olds. I have a 2-year-old, and she is constantly navigating between needing me and wanting her independence. And I see her behavior is very similar to the adolescents I study, that they want to be independent. They want to be respected and given the autonomy to seek things out on their own. But at the same time, they need the love and the scaffolding and the encouragement when they do fall and when they make mistakes.
I've been interested to see that the teachers my kids relate best to are not the ones who act like they're teenagers too. These are people who are full adults, but they make it clear that they like teenagers.
Yes, I think that is a very simple, powerful, but understated message that we like teenagers and we respect teenagers and teenagers can do really good things in the world.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with, Lynn in Fort Worth. Hi, Lynn. Lynn, are you with us? Okay, we do not have, Lynn, hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead.
Okay, anything about mindfulness practices in relation to teenage studies, the brain and behavior?
Have you looked into that?
I have not personally looked into mindfulness in the teenage brain, but the majority of studies have focused on younger kids and determining how mindfulness can help them show better attention, for instance, in the classroom. And there, some results are promising, but some are mixed. And so it really, I think, depends, again, on the type of intervention.
How interested are the teenagers that you study in what you're studying?
Very interested. So I am lucky to have the opportunity to speak to teenagers in high schools and go to different assemblies, and they really want to hear this. They want to know what is going on in their brain, because they too recognize that their behaviors change. Their physical growth is rapidly changing during this time. And so it helps contextualize from a science perspective the everyday life and experience that they are having.
Is it your sense that adolescence is a miserable time? So many people remember, say, high school with just like not a fond memory.
I think it's mixed. I think some adolescents love being adolescents. And I you know, observe that just, you know, in the mall, you see gaggles of teenagers who are just having the best time, more fun than anyone.
Is the human brain ever finished developing?
Well, when do we stop developing and start maturing is a big question. And in part, it's probably when we start losing that sense of developmental plasticity, but there's no way right now that we can quantify that.
Do you feel like we're just at the beginning of what we understand about this moment, this period in development?
Yes, the study of adolescent brain development is actually, you know, we've made some strides, but we have a lot to learn, especially because earlier studies on the adolescent brain really focused on the negative attributes and, you know, rather pathologized it. But in fact, we're learning that there's much more positive there than we've previously focused on.
You think there might be roles in society that teenagers specifically should fill that are good, not just for them and their development, but for everybody else?
That's a really good question. Yeah, that's a good idea. If we could come up with ways that to kind of involve them more and not treat them as a separate group of people, then we could probably do all of us some good.
Do you remember the moment when you felt like an adult? Was there a time for you?
I think when I first got my first job, my mm-hmm. first real job as a professor, I felt like an adult. Even though I felt like an adult, but I was kind of a kid hiding like an adult and pretending to be an adult.
Yeah, it's just interesting the way for all of us there is that sense at first that you're just pretending to be
exactly.
a grown-up, and then you start to feel it after a while.
Yeah.
Behavioral neuroscientist Adriana Galvan is associate professor in the Department of Psychology at the Brain Research Institute at UCLA. You can find a link to more information about her work at think.kera.org. Adriana, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you very much for making
time
for us.
Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. Mine is at Chris Boyd Think. Subscribe to our podcast and find out about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.